stand by. We're about to begin. And thank you for standing by, and welcome to today's WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mary Rees. Ms. Rees, please go ahead.
Thank you, Joanne. Hi, and welcome to today's WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. My name is Mary Rees, and I will be the moderator for today's call. This call is being recorded, and within 24 to 48 hours, an MP3 file and the presentation will be available on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site, so you may replay at any time at your convenience. If you have not yet joined the e-meeting, please do so now. An e-meeting URL is available to you from the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. If you are unable to access the e-meeting at this time, you may access the presentation from IBM.com and typing in the number 700-6809 in the search box in the black section at the very top of the page. This will return one document that contains the PDF file of the presentation. You may also instant message the co-moderator, Lee Perlov, by clicking on lee_perlov@us.ibm.com in the e-meeting attendee list, and he will assist you. Today's presenter is Scott McClure. He is currently working in the CICS Level 2 support team, where he has worked since August 1989. He is responsible for remote support of CICS, providing analysis and implementation assistance to IBM customers worldwide. Today's topic is KICS and security. Scott will explain how security works in a KICS MRO and LU62 environment. During the presentation, all lines will be muted. After the presentation, the lines will be open for a question and answer session. If you are in the e-meeting, you will see the presentation now. At this point, I would like to turn the meeting over to Scott.
Hello all, good day, wherever you may be residing. I'm Scott McClure, and we'll go ahead and jump right into this, I guess. Mary, we'll go to page 2, please. This is our agenda. We're going to talk about SIP parameters, not explicitly every SIP parameter that has to do with security, but I'm going to touch base on a few of them. Then we're going to talk about some changes to ExecKick sign-on and sign-off that happened at version 2 CICS. Then we're going to jump into MRO security, followed by LU62 security. Those are the main two security topics I am going to talk about because of an interest in time. Security is such a huge topic, I had to narrow in on something. Then we'll have a look at the U.S. domain via IPCS, and then I have some sample traces. Page 3, please. So here are the SIP parameters, the main parameter being security equals yes or no. That's basically your on-off switch. I'm listing other SIP parameters as well that have to do with security. You have notes pages following each one of these pages explaining what they all do. Again, I'm not going to talk about every one of them. Just going to highlight a few. Page 4, please. This is one of the notes pages that explains the parameters we just saw. Page 5, please. These are additional SIP parameters that have to do with security. I wanted to point out USR delay on this one, and I'm wanting to point it out because it has to do with performance. USR delay will determine how long of a time period we will continue to remember remote sign-ons. The default is 30 minutes, which seems to be a very good value for most all customers. If you do play with this, and meaning lowering the value, there's going to be a performance cost on that. I've seen customers that went to zero, and that can cause up to a 30% degradation. So the time, when that time period expires, what we do is basically we tear down all the control blocks that remember that remote sign-on, and therefore when the user comes in again, we have to rebuild all those control blocks as well. So this is a time period of how long we're going to remember that user before we do tear down and have to rebuild. I have X Command highlighted on this page, but I didn't mean to talk about it. That's just a mistake. Page 6, please. This just is another notes page explaining the parameters on the previous page. I'm not going to actually speak to this, but wanted you to have it in hand. Page 7, please. Additional SIP parameters, just wanted to point out the main one, XTRAN. That's where you get your transaction security checking. Most everyone runs with this turned on. Basically, the main reason for having security. So I wanted to point that one out. That's all I'm going to discuss on this page. Page 8, please. Again, additional notes page describing the previous page and what all those parameters do. Page 9, please. This is just a page showing SIP parameters that have the capability of being abbreviated, such as security would be SEC, security class, SEC class. Just pointing out the ones that could be abbreviated. Page 10, please. Okay, we're going to talk about the changes to ExecKick sign-on and sign-off. These changes occur at version 2 of CICS. In pre-version 2, XTS13 and earlier, when an application would do an ExecKick sign-on or sign-off, they were immediately recognized, which would mean that the user ID that the transaction is running under could be allowed to be changed during mid-flight of the task. And because of that, it would cause unpredictable results with resource managers that are out there not being able to recognize if a change did happen mid-flight. Some of those resource managers would be like IMS and DB2 and VSAM. So we changed ExecKick sign-on and sign-off in KixTS 2.1 and above so that the sign-on and the sign-off operations are considered terminal-related only, meaning not just task-related. And because of that, we changed the state of the principal facility to reflect the correct sign-on extension that's associated with that terminal. And the current user ID and security capabilities are not actually affected for the transaction that issued the ExecKick sign-on or sign-off. It's not until the next transaction that runs on against that terminal where the actual new sign-on or sign-off would be recognized. Now, this may affect applications if you are going from 1.3 to version 2. And if this doesn't work for you, then we have come up with an exit program called DFH Dollar Snacks. And then there's a DFH Dollar SNPI, which is another program that can be run at PLT time to actually enable the exit. And what this will do is revert the behavior that you're used to in 1.3 and below to exactly what you are used to. Page 11, please. Well, I did want to say that those exits are programs to revert you back to 1.3 and before are available up until 3.1. It will eventually be taken away, so you need to keep this in mind for if possible changes that you might would have to make to your applications if the new way of working doesn't fit into how your transactions operate. The This is just a notes page explaining what we just discussed. Page 12, please. Okay, we're going to go ahead and jump into MRO security. There's a thing called bind time security with MRO, which is not optional, and it's performed in two phases. There's a log on time and a connect time. And it's log on time is performed whenever a KEX region logs on to the IRC program, DFH IRP. And each CICS region user ID must have access to its own DFH Apple ID profile in the facility class of your security package. That is, if the facility class is active, then at connect time, that is performed when a partner region is connecting to a region. And the security needed for that would be each KIX region user ID has to have read access to that partner's DFH Apple ID profile in the facility class. And again, that's if the facility class is active and you have DFH Apple profiles. Page 13, please. This is just a notes page explaining what we just discussed. Maybe the last paragraph explains that we will allow the connects, again, if the facility class is not active or there is no security manager installed or there is no profile in the facility class. Page 13, please, or 14. Link security with MRO, and when I say link, I'm basically talking about a session. And what link security will do is restrict the resources that a remote user can access depending on what remote system they're trying to access this region from. And each link between system is given access authority that's defined by a link user ID. In MRO, the link user ID is assigned as the TOR region. And I'm going to say TOR, AOR, meaning TOR is the sender, AOR is the receiver. So, and it's the receiving side that cares about security. In MRO, that link user ID is assigned as the TOR's region user ID if you don't specifically define it in a connection or sessions definition. If you do specifically define a link user ID in MRO, you have to do that via the session's definition with the user ID equals parameter. And if you do define it that way, it's known as preset security. There is a parameter on the connection definition called security name, but that's ignored in MRO. One thing to remember that if you're transaction routing or function shipping, there will always at least be one security check made, meaning against that link user ID, whatever that may be. If it's preset, it would be that user ID. If it's not preset, it'll be the TOR's region user ID sent in. Page 15, please. In terms to understand, attached SAC, which is coded on the connection definition. And again, it's the receiving side that cares, so he will know what to expect. You can code in MRO, attached SAC equals local or identify. Local means that there will not be a user ID passed by the connection region, meaning the real user signed on to the TOR, that user ID won't be passed. If you have identify, then the incoming attach request must supply a user ID within the attached FMH file that gets sent with the request. That would be the real user ID being sent. Equivalent systems means that the link user ID that we just discussed, coded on the session's definition, matches the local region user ID or the AOR's region user ID. Again, that's known as preset security. And another way to have equivalent systems would be is if the connected region was running with the same region user ID as the local region user ID, meaning the TOR and the AOR are both running under the same user ID, that would be considered equivalent systems as well. Page 16, please. Excuse me. TASSEC local, because no end user ID is passed by the connected region, then the authority that end user is granted would be that of the link itself. If the user ID equals is not coded on the session's definition, meaning preset security, then again the region user ID of the TOR is used to make that link security check. If the user ID equals is specifically coded on the session's definition, that would be preset security. And if it matched the local region user ID, which would be equivalent systems, then the link security check will be made against the default user ID of the local region to make the link security check. That would be the AOR's default user ID. If the user ID is specifically coded on a session's definition and it doesn't match the AOR's region user ID, you still have preset security, but not equivalent systems, and that preset user ID would be the user ID used to make the link security check. Page 17, please. That was TASSEC local. Now we're going to talk about TASSEC identify, which means that there is an end user user ID that will be sent from the TOR to the AOR in the attached FMH5 to run the transaction. Now with identify, if the user ID is not coded on the session's definition, so you're not presetting, then the region user ID of the TOR is used to make the link security check, but in addition to the link security check, there's a second security check that's made against the user ID that's passed in that FMH5. If the user ID is specifically coded on the session's definition, preset security, and it matches the local region user ID, you again have equivalent systems. And in this situation, we will bypass the link security check because of equivalent systems, meaning I think I am myself, so there's no reason to check the link. And then you would just basically check the real user ID passed in by the FMH5 to make any decisions. In doing it this way, it will reduce the number of rack route calls to the security manager by half because you're not having to check that link check every time. Again, you rely on the security check being made against the real user ID passed from the TOR. If the user ID is specifically coded on the local session definition and it doesn't match the local region user ID, you still have preset security. And that preset user ID would be used to make the link security check. And then again, you would have a second security check made against the real user ID. So in that instance, you have two checks actually being made. Page 18, please. This is just another notes page explaining what we just discussed on the previous. Page 19, please. User security with MRO. This applies only if you have a TASSEC identifier, and again, that's because it takes a TASSEC identifier to cause the real user ID to be passed from the TOR. The security check is made against the user ID that's passed in that FMH5. Again, this is additional to link security if applicable, meaning we did not bypass the link check due to coding of equivalent systems. The sign-on status, the remote user will remain signed on after the first attach request is complete. This is where USR delay comes into play, remembering that remote user in case he comes in again with another request. We don't have to rebuild all the control blocks. We will simply remember him. And therefore, we will use that same user. We'll accept them without doing a new sign-on until the USR delay expires or until the KIC system is terminated. Page 20, please. Page 20 is just another notes page explaining what I just discussed. Page 21. We just discussed user security. Now, this is transaction security. And for transactions to run, the link must have sufficient authority to initiate that transaction. And with it, and that's assuming only attachsec local was coded. If you had attachsec identified, then the actual user making that request must also have sufficient authority to access the system and to initiate that transaction. 22, please. Just a little bit about resource and command security checking in MRO. We will only perform these checks if the installed transaction definition specifies that they are required. You use the ResSec and CommandSec parameters in the transaction. Both of these values can be overridden using the SIP parameter of ResSec equals always and CommandSec equals always if you didn't want to specifically code by transaction. If you're running with resource security or command security, other associated SIP parameters that must also be turned on would be X command, yes, of course, that would be for command security. XSCT, XJCT, that's for file control and journal control. I didn't name all the X parameters, that's why I have an XAAA. So if you were doing resource security checking, say against files, then you would need XFCT equals yes or a name of your own class that you would be checking if you're not defaulting. With the TASSEC local, I've said this several times, we're just going to repeat it. The link user ID has to have authority to the resources that the attached transaction accesses, and the link user ID must have sufficient authority to the commands the attached transaction issues. With identify, both the link and the user ID that's passed in the FMH5 have to have that authority. Page 23, please. Transaction routing security with MRO. On the TOR, the security check is made to make sure that the user has access to the transaction that's defined as remote. And basically, that just determines whether or not the user is allowed to run the relay program to get it over to the AOR. Again, it's the AOR that truly cares about most of security or the receiving side. On the AOR, the transaction's principal facility is known as a surrogate terminal, and it represents the real terminal that you were signed on to or logged on to in the TOR. And the definition of that remote terminal affects how user security is applied. 24, please. How it affects is what we're going to talk about now. If that remote terminal definition exists in the AOR but does not specify the user ID parameter, that would mean he's not preset, and with Atastec Local, transaction command and resource security are all limited by the authority of the link user ID. But with Atastec Identify, transaction and resource security of the user are established when the remote user is signed on in that AOR or receiving side. And that signed on user ID has the security capability assigned in the remote region. When the remote terminal exists in the AOR and does specify the user ID, meaning he has preset a user ID on that remote terminal, then the preset user ID will be signed on and used for the user security checks. And Atastec will have the same effect as we just discussed above. When there's no remote terminal that exists on the AOR, the preset security characteristics of that surrogate are determined from the terminal definition that's shipped from the TOR. And again, Atastec has the same effect as we just discussed. Page 25, please. This is just a notes page that covers what we just discussed. Page 26. This is just a chart showing the security checks that are done in the AOR when you have MRO with Atastec Local. This is straight out of the book. It's a very nice chart to know which user IDs are going to be checked when I have a combination of definitions. I'm not going to go over the entire chart, but we'll take like the first and the last. So in the first example, the region user ID for the AOR is user ID A, and I'm not specifying a user ID on my sessions definition, meaning I'm not presetting. My region user ID for my TOR is also user ID A, which would mean I have equivalent systems because they're the same. And therefore, the checking that I do in the AOR is a check against the AOR's default user. And that's because I'm equivalent systems, and there always has to be at least one check. If we just jump to the bottom, my AOR's region user ID is user ID A. I have preset my session with user ID B. My region user ID is anything. It doesn't matter. The check that I'm going to do in the AOR is a check against user ID B, and that's because I preset that link, and there's only one link, only one check with Atastec Local. So that's how you use the chart. It's very helpful, nice to have. Page 27, please. Okay, this is just another chart, just as we just went over with Atastec Local, but this shows the example of Atastec Identify. I think you got my gist from the preview on the previous slide, so I don't see the need to spend time on it. Just wanted you to have it. Page 28, please. That's all we're really going to talk about on MRO. LU62 we're going to jump into. There's also bind time security with LU62. If you remember, it was not optional on MRO, but it is optional on LU62. And again, it prevents unauthorized systems from binding a session to CICS. To have bind time security, Both sides of the connection must support bind time security. The way you implement it, you have to have sec equals yes in the SIT, both sides, well, both sides if we're talking CICS. And I'm not sure I should have said that because I'm thinking only CICS would play in bind time security. So it is sec equals yes in the SIT on both sides. APPC SIT parameter has to be set to yes on both sides. And on the connection definition, you would specify bind security equals yes on both sides. Then there's something known as a session key that both sides must have. And this session key is defined within an APPC LU general resource class in RACF or your equivalent security package. Page 29, please. This is simply a notes page describing the previous page. 30, please. Additional notes about bind time security. Page 31, please. Now we're going to talk about link security with LU6.2. Again, it restricts the resources that the remote user can access depending on what the remote system from which they're trying to access from. Each link between the system is given access authority defined by link user ID just as in MRO. But there's an additional way to define a link user ID using security name on the connection definition. You can either code that or you can code user ID equals on the sessions definition just like you did in MRO. Again, security name was not valid for MRO, but it is for LU6.2. If you code both security name and user ID in the sessions definition, then the user ID on the sessions definition will override anything coded for security name if both are coded. If you're not presetting a user ID, then the link user ID is taken to be the local region's default user ID, which is different than we saw in the case of MRO. Remember, in MRO, it was always the TOR's region user ID pass. In LU6.2, we don't know who that partner may be, so it's going to default to the link default user ID of the receiving CICS. And as I mentioned in MRO, when you have transaction routing or function shipping, there will always at least be one security check made. Page 32, please. 32 is simply link security notes page. Page 33. User security with LU6.2. Applies only if a TASSEC is coded as non-local, meaning it's not a TASSEC local. There are other parameters that can be coded for a TASSEC, such as identify, verify. I didn't list them all, but that's why I'm calling it non-local. And just as in MRO, this causes a second security check to be made against the user ID signed on to the terminal. Page 34, please. With the TASSEC non-local, the remote user again remains signed on after the first attach request is complete, and it requests from the same user from the same port of entry are continued to be accepted without a new sign-on until either USR delay expires or the KIC system is terminated, just as in MRO. It's 35, please. Just as in MRO, with a tax set local, the link must have sufficient authority to initiate the transaction. If you have a tax set non-local, then the link must have the sufficient authority as well as the user making the request. That's the second security check made, just like an MRO. Page 36, please. This is basically just a repeat of what we went over in MRO. I just wanted to place this in both sections, so if you jump from one section to the other or just were interested in one of the sections, you would have it there as well. Everything's exactly the same, and we've already discussed this. Page 37, please. Again, just repeating basically what we said in MRO, on the TOR, the security checks made to ensure that the user has access to the remote transaction that was defined, and just as in MRO, basically that check just makes sure that the user is allowed to run the relay program, and it's the receiving side that cares. And on that AOR is the transaction's principal facility, which is known as a surrogate, that represents the real terminal in the TOR, and how that remote terminal is defined would affect how the user security is applied. Just wanted you to, again, have it in both places. Page 38, please. This is a very long page as well that it's a repeat what we've discussed in the MRO. Again, just wanted you to have it in both places, so I don't see the need to jump into this either. Page 39. Page 39 is just preset security notes. It says we had in the MRO. Page 40. I gave you the chart for MRO previously, and this is a chart showing the checks that would be made in an LU62 environment. Notice it's a lot larger because you can have a lot more combinations of what can be coded. You read it the same way. I don't see the need for me to explain one of these. It's pretty self-explanatory. Just the different combinations and what would actually be checked. And this chart shows for the attached sec equals local. Page 41. Page 41 is just the same type of chart for LU62 with attached sec equals non-local. That's all I'm really going to say. Page 42. Okay, we're going to jump into a little bit of the control blocks in a dump. The way I got this screen was IPCS, and I did at the top of the screen. You can see the command that I did, which happened to be verbex DFHPD630 with US equals 3. And the first thing we see is the user domain summary. And this is, and under that, you have the USXD summary. You'll have a USXD for each task that is currently active. I only had one task active, which was transaction number 90. And his principal token is number 6. That represents the token of what my user ID would be. If you look lower on the screen, under the USUD summary, there's a column called token in the first column, and if you look there, you'll see the 6. And 6 is associated with user ID USASSC2. And then you can see the other columns give you more information about that user ID. One thing I wanted to point out was when you're looking at the U.S. domain, token 1 is always the region's default user ID. And token 2 is always the region's The token 1 is always the default user ID, and token 2 is always the region user ID. Page 43, please. This is continuing on with more control blocks in the U.S. domain. We have at the top the U.S. domain anchor block. My pointer is a little off because of making this in the PDF format. I apologize. But that's meant to show that offset 54 always points to the USUD, which is user data control block, for the default user ID. Below the anchor, we have a USXD. Again, we have a USXD for every task that is active. I've highlighted in red the offset 0 there. We're going to see it on the next page. My page just wasn't big enough. But just below at offset 10, you can see that was my token of 6. So if we jump to page 44, we can see that that USXD we saw on the previous page is pointing to the USUD, which is the user data control block, and the actual user data starts at offset 1 Fox, where we have a 07 there. That's actually the length of the user ID of USASSC2. Below that, we can see the next USUD is for token 2. Again, that's the region user ID. Then we have another one for token 5, etc. I just wanted to point out that the USUD is pointed to by the USXD on the previous page. Page 45, please. So one thing that I didn't mention as well is that the XM domain also has tokens. And I'm highlighting the U.S. token column there for my CEMT task. Remember, it was transaction number 90. There's always two words. And the first word of that U.S. token will point to the actual user data portion of the USUD, which, remember, was 1 Fox into the control block. And then the second word will always point to the associated USXD. I got this screen by typing in the Verbex DFH PD630 with XM. Page 46, please. I wanted to mention AP trace components. In shooting problems with user IDs not being the right ones or getting the wrong one from a session, etc., this is a good thing to turn on is the AP 1-2 tracing in CETR. And what that will give you is a before and after trace entry before, like a sign on or a sign off, and gives you the after. What I wanted to point out here is in the first one, in the next before, we have our TCTTE address, and data area 2 is actually the SNEX itself, or the sign-on extension. Offset 0 into that is my user token, and then offset 4 would be my session token if there was one associated. So I don't know what function was being done to get these trace entries. I can't remember, but on the SNEX before, we can see that we didn't have a user token in offset 0 in date area 2, but on the SNEX after trace entry, We now can see that I'm associated with a token of 4. And if I formatted out my U.S. domain, I could go find that token and associate it to a user ID. Page 47. Page 47 is a SNCS notes page. I will talk about this a little bit. The important parts, as I just mentioned, of a SNCS or a sign-on extension would be offset 0, 4, and 20, where offset 0 is my SNCS principal user token, 4 is my SNCS session user token, and offset 20 has various flags in it that would indicate the presence of a session token, whether or not it was preset security, and other things like that. Nice to know. Page 48. In an interest of time, I have a lot of example traces in here, and because of time, wanting to keep this down to a reasonable time period, I'm going to jump from page 48 to page 57, but I want you to be aware there are ExecKick sign-on trace and some other traces previous to where we're jumping to. You can look at those on your at your leisure. We're going to jump to page 57, which is our transaction route trace example. And in this example, this trace is going to show a transaction route of a transaction called REMT, which is basically my remote CEMT transaction. And we're going to look at it from the perspective of the receiving region, which is IYNXQ in this case. And my connection definition name is Q to L. My transaction REMT was entered on a terminal called TC26 in the TOR. That terminal was logged on to a region IYNXL, and it was signed on by a user ID of USASSC3. My region user ID for IYNXL is USASSC4. My region user ID of IYNXQ, which is my receiving guy, is USASSC5. In this example, my sessions are not preset, meaning I do not have a user ID on my sessions definition, and I'm running with a TAPSEC identify. Therefore, a real user ID is going to be passing the FMH5 from my TOR to my AOR. Page 56, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Page 58. I misspoke there. Okay, this is the first trace entry at the top, trace entry 130. It's showing the IRC inbound RU. Data area 2 is showing a attach FMH5. I can tell that by the 85 in byte 2, and the 02 fox fox means it's an attach FMH5. If I scroll over on the line a little bit where I have the 08 highlighted and underlined, that's the length of the user ID followed by the user ID itself, which in this case is USASSC3. I don't have all the trace. It's just excerpts of the trace. Otherwise, we'd be here all night. Okay, so just wanted to show that attach FMH5 coming in. Z-attach is going to attach my REMT task as number 232 to a session called less than AAF. First thing I do in trace 158 is look for my remote definition for my terminal, TC26. On trace entry 160, I can see I exited that locate with a not found. And then at trace entry 162, that's my transformer 3 What he's going to do is pack up information, send it back to the TOR, asking the TOR to ship my terminal definition. And while I'm here talking about the transformer, just a little hint, if you were looking at a trace and you're not sure if you're looking at an AOR trace or a TOR trace, the transformer trace entries can certainly indicate that for you, meaning transformer 1 always packs up information and sends it out, which would be, for instance, on the TOR or the sender side or the initiator. Transformer 2 always receives that information and unpacks it, then which would be on the receiving side, which would be my AOR. And then Transformer 3 also packs up information and sends it out, but always runs on the AOR, the receiving side. And that's what we're seeing right here, Transformer 3 packing up and sending out. So Transformer 3 always runs on the AOR, and then Transformer 4 always runs on the TOR, and he unpacks that information Transformer 3 sent. So just for your notes, Transformer 1 and Transformer 4 run on a TOR, and Transformer 2 and Transformer 3 run on an AOR, or TOR meaning sender and AOR meaning receiver. It's nice to know. Okay, so we sent that out asking the TOR to ship it. Jumping down to trace entry 170, we see that go out of the AOR, and we go into our IRLink wait, waiting for that response to come back. Page 59, please. Remember, we were in our wait, IRC link wait, waiting for this to come back. And here comes at the top, trace entry 177, data coming back in from IYNXL. It's an inbound RU, trace entry 179. And then trace entry 185, we see, or 186, we see the transformer 2 receiving that information to unpack it. I know I'm on my AOR. We unpacked that information. That was the shipping the terminal information. And so now we are going to attach transaction CITS, which is trace entry 190, to install that definition, that terminal, that remote terminal, TC26. I've cut a lot of that out, but CITS did run. I've got a note in there. Trace entry 680, we see that the remote install was complete. And trace entry 733, we're doing a Z-look again for the terminals to see if we can find him this time. Trace entry 735, you can see response normal. We did find him now. Page 60, please. Okay, so we start running the REMT, and at trace entry 745, notice I have AP12 on, and therefore I'm getting my SNECs before my sign-on of my surrogates. And this shows the surrogate TCTTE as well as the session TTE, what their addresses are. State area 1 is the address of my surrogate TCTTE, followed by data area 2, which would be the SNECs associated with him. And then data area 3 and 4 are the address and the associated SNECs of the session TCTTE. So before I do my sign-on, my terminal is not signed on because I have zeros for a token, and my session itself at offset 4 does not have a token, so he is not signed on either. I'm sorry. At date area 4, my session does have a token of 9, meaning he signed on with token 9 or whatever user ID is associated with 9. You'd have to go to the U.S. domain to see that. At offset 20, I have a 48. I think I mentioned at the bottom here what the 48 means. I don't. Sorry. But anyway, the SNEX for the surrogate before the sign-on has a token of zeros, meaning my default user, by the way. If I have zeros, it's going to be the default user. And the SNEX for the session before the sign-on has a token of 9. And the sign-on of that surrogate is basically going to cause the session token to be propagated from the SNEX of the session to the SNEX of the surrogate. And that's what you can see in the SNEX after sign-on surrogate trace entry. You can see it went up. I'm looking for it to go down, and it went up. You can see from date area 4 that it did have the 9, and it's propagated up into the SNEX of the surrogate TCTTE in the offset 4. Or for that delay, I was looking for it to go down, and it was going up. Page 61, please. So now we're going to do a sign-on attach header for my user ID that was passed from the TOR, which was USASSC3, and I have my, at trace entry 751, my SNEX before. So now I'm really signing on that real user. And my before sign-on extension now has the 9 at offset 4, which is my session token, but I have zeros, or the default user, for this user ID before I sign him on. At trace entry 756, we're doing an add user without password. That's basically adding him to the U.S. domain. And at trace entry 758, you can see when I exit, I now have a token of Baker, which will represent the USASSC3. Page 62, please. So now that I have my token of Baker at trace entry 790, you can see my SNEX after, which is the sign-on of that real user, and now I have my token of Baker at offset 0, and I have my token of 9 at offset 4. Trace entry 804 is just basically adding him to the XS domain. Page 63, please. Page 63 at a trace entry 820 is basically showing the actual calls to the security domain to check REMT for token Baker. And a check for USASSC3 at trace entry 821. It basically is showing both of the security checks, one for the link and one for the real user ID, link being the token of 9. Page 64, please. This is just supporting documentation showing the U.S. domain where now I have added USASSC3 with a token of Baker to the U.S. domain. Page 65, please. That was the MRO transaction route trace. This next one is a transaction route trace with AU62. Same transaction, same region user IDs, In this case, the sessions are, again, not preset, meaning I'm not coding a user ID on the session, and I'm not coding security name on the connection definition, and I have a TASSEC identify. Page 66, please. Very similar to the MRO trace. Except here on trace entry 144, we have VIO trace entry, which represents OU62, coming in with my begin bracket, my change direction, and my FMH. Trace entry 145 is where I attach the task to minus AAD, is going to be the name of my session. Middle ways in the page, you can see where REMT begins as task number 62. Just like in the MRO trace at trace entry 226, we look for our remote terminal. In this case, we got a response of normal, so he found him. So we don't. We're going to jump to page 67. This is my trace entry 238 showing my SNECs before the sign-on of the surrogate. We again have zeros for the SNECs session, and the default user ID is being used. As an MRO, the sign on the surrogate causes the session token to be propagated from the SNECs of the session to the SNECs of the surrogate. In this one, it's not easily seen because the session is not signed on with the TOR region user ID as we saw on MRO, and the session is not preset with a user ID. However, we can still see the propagation if you look in the SNECs before. On data area 4 at offset 20, we had a 58. And after the propagation, if you look at the SNECs after sign-on surrogate trace entry, data area 4, you can see that changed from a 58 to a 10, and the 48 was propagated up into the SNECs of the surrogate terminal. Okay, the next thing at trace entry 243, we're doing the sign-on attach header for USA SSC2 this time, and it's non-local. Page 68. This is my SNECs before the sign-on of the real user ID. I have zeros as my user token, meaning I'm the default user before sign-on. And if I look at the SNECs after on trace entry 263, I now have a token of 4. See how these AP trace entries are can be very helpful in trying to shoot a problem that is associated with the wrong user ID or whatever. Trace entry 264, we exit that sign on attach header. Trace entry 269, we're doing the add transaction, principal security token of 4 and 1 for the session. I mentioned before, if I have a token of 0, this is a default user. Well, a token of 1 is truly a default user, and if you have zeros, we make it the default user because there isn't a token. So if you see zeros or 1, you're going to end up with the default user. That's just showing that the session has the default user ID associated. Page 69. This is showing the actual checks being made against the real user and the link. And then my transaction continues to run. Page 70, this is just the supporting U.S. domain summary showing what we just went through, where you can see my token of 4 for USA SSC2 is now in the user domain. Again, the token of 1 is my CICS user ID or my default user ID. Age 71. This is just a promo of the Kick Support website. I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of it. If you haven't used it, you certainly should check it out. There's a lot of useful information and things you can actually do from there, like order maintenance, PSP buckets, etc. Just a promo for that. It's at page 72. These are just references of manuals that I used to build the pitch. Page 73. I'm not familiar with this page. Someone else must have stuck this in. Sorry. Page 74. Q&A.
Okay, Duane, at this point we'd like to open the lines for questions.
Very good. For the phone audience, if you'd like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key, followed by the digit 1. If you've been utilizing your mute button, you'll make sure that's disengaged. And again, star 1 if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. And we'll first go to Mike Giaquinto with Wells Fargo.
Hi, thanks. Scott, Mike Giaquinto, nice to speak to you and listen to you. You've helped me quite a bit recently.
Hi, Mike.
And Mary, too. Many years ago, you even showed me things like those VIO traces. So, so welcome back. But anyway, I have a simple question and maybe one that's a little more detailed. And the simple one is, in the trace that you were showing, what was the level of excess tracing that you were using?
It was level 1.
Just level 1. All right, good. And then the other one, you had mentioned earlier on, user delay equals 30 as the default and 0 as a performance hit. Our security guys are coming to us because as we have people changing passwords in a multi-LPAR, multi-CPSM routing, multi-region environment, they change the password on one LPAR, and because user delay is set higher for performance reasons, they, when they run on a different LPAR, don't see the changes and they get security violations. Is that common? Is that particular to the top secret that we're using? And is there a way to get the best of both worlds, to when they make their changes, to get it refreshed all over without having to decrease user delay down to 0.
That is common. There's no way around it, and it's not a specific security package. It's just the way CICS works and how long we remember the user ID. And because we remember it, when you change password or something like that, that's why you're not seeing the immediate change until that expires. We tear him down, and then on the next time the user comes in, we rebuild it. It might be possible if you're like adding a user to be able to access a specific TRAN or something, you could get around it by specifically giving access to that specific TRAN. I believe that would get you around that part. But as far as changing passwords, I don't see a way around that.
Thanks very much.
And again, star 1 if you do have a question or comment at this time. Queue is open for questions. Well, with that, there are no further questions. Let's turn the conference back to Mary Rees.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. So at this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope this information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate that you've come to listen. Remember, a replay of this presentation is going to be available on the Technical Exchange site within the next couple of days. We hope you all join us for future presentations, which will also be announced on that same site. Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you, Scott, for presenting.
Mm-hmm.